Okay, to turn this thing down, get it out of our way.
I'm not going to say no.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm liable to hit it. Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to get to be with you. And the most important pleasure for me is to have my Marilyn with me. So if you haven't met her yet, she's sitting right up here on the front. And you have an extra job when services are over. You need to come down and meet Marilyn, because she's the most important part of this couple here. And it's a special pleasure to have her with me on this journey. I travel a lot, and over the last several years, I haven't been able to take her with me very much. So understand, it's one of the blessed privileges of my life to have my beloved with me. And she is. 52 years, she's more beloved than ever. All right. Thank you for the privilege of working with you this evening. And most of you are probably aware that I've spent a good deal of my life dealing with the general theme of the subject of creation versus evolution. And so I thought it would be good to give you a little bit of updated information tonight on that general theme. I hope you're ready for a little bit of science class, because that's what we're going to do primarily this evening. Thank you for the invitation. So the question this evening is, origins. Is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? And I will tell you, there are lots of folks in the intelligent community, the scientific community, who would say to you, absolutely not. In fact, anyone who still believes in God in this scientific age needs to go back to the Middle Ages. You're out of step. Humanity has learned so much more in the last centuries, and the more we learn, the less there is a need for God. After all, God was invented to fill the gaps of our knowledge, and the more we learn, the less we need God. So, it is absolutely the case that there are hosts of people in our age who would answer this question in the negative. No, it's not reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age. So, part of my responsibility this evening is to tell you I answer this in the positive. In fact, I believe there is less excuse than ever for missing that there is a God. So I want to talk to you about that a little bit. The song we just sang is a very special song to me, written by Brother A.W. Dykus in 1966. It's special to me for a number of reasons. Brother A.W. Dykus was a brother in Christ. He was also the academic dean at Florida College. I literally sat in his seat because I was academic dean for 18 years at Florida College. And I also sat at Brother Dykus' feet as a student in the 1960s. Some of you think that was before the flood. It was not. Brother Dykus was a great scientist and well respected. He was a physicist and deeply believed that physics and all of the sciences testified to the existence of God. I am honored to stand in his footsteps. Brother Dykus' song was written in 1966, I'm convinced, because it was the peak of the God is Dead movement in the United States of America in those days. That didn't start with us, but in the 1800s, Fred Nietzsche, German poet and philosopher heavily influenced by evolution, started the notion that God is dead. In 1966, Time magazine featured, "Is God Dead?" April the 8th issue was all about the dead God. And in that article, in the several articles that were in that magazine, one was quoting Thomas J. Altizer and William Hamilton in their book Radical Theology and the Death of God, and here was the quote: "We must realize the death of God is an historical event, that God has died in our cosmos, in our history, and that the dead God is the God of the historic Christian church, and beyond the church, of Christendom at large. So it's your God, folks, that died. Aren't you part of Christendom?" according to Altizer and Hamilton, both of whom are preachers, theologians, they were testifying in the 1960s that God has died. And the reason he died is because we don't need him anymore. And of course, if one thinks God died, somehow he must have been invented by us in the first place. And of course, that's the notion. Humans invented God to fill in the gaps. And now we don't need him anymore. So God is dead. Well, I'm convinced Brother Dykus wanted to speak very vocally and forcefully against that notion. And so I hope you were singing from the depths of your heart when you said, "There is a God. He is alive. In him we live and we survive." Did you mean that when you sang it? I hope so. Sometimes songs can become so rote you're not even thinking about what you're singing. Please think about that song. You were singing, I hope, what you fundamentally believe, that God not only exists, but he's alive and well, and he functions in this world. But lots of folks don't believe that. Let's go to Romans chapter 1. Romans 1 is the theme passage for the entire series that I do. And I should tell you, this series is normally at least 6 lessons. It could easily be 25 lessons. It could easily be a 2-year course. So when I talk to you tonight and I speak rapidly, please understand, I have 1 hour to say an awful lot of things I want to say to you tonight. Romans 1 verse 18 beginning says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." This was written in the first century, folks. It sounds like the 21st century. "Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." This, ladies and gentlemen, is the strongest statement in all of Scripture that there is evidence for God in the natural world. In fact, you can see God, even though he's invisible. How do you do that? You see him through the things that are made. You see, the argument is, if the evidence of the natural world is that there are objects here that have been designed or made, the clear implication is somebody made them. And what you should learn from nature is that whoever it was that made these things must be eternally powerful and must be divine. That is not part of this natural world. So you should at least be able to know from nature that there is a God that's powerful beyond belief and who is not part of the natural world. He's supernatural. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the most famous argument for the existence of God from the natural world. It's the argument from design. And that's the argument I use in all of my lectures. So I'd like to take that argument from design and expand upon it this evening in one particular realm, which I hope you will thoroughly appreciate. And I allow no sleeping in my class. We had a big lunch, and if I were sitting there, I'd be getting sleepy. I don't allow it. And I'm watching you. I have been known to make everybody stand up. So here we go, class. I call this lesson "Design at the Macroscopic Level." We're talking about the massive universe in which we exist. I believe everywhere you look, there's evidence for design. I want to show you why. I hope there's somebody either here tonight or listening. I understand we're recording this. If you're listening to this later and you're not a believer in God, thank you for listening. There are a lot of folks so closed-minded they don't even want to hear what I'm about to say. I thank you for listening. I hope by the time I finish, you will see there is abundant evidence in the design of the universe that somebody did this. This did not happen by accidental natural causes, by the forces of physics acting upon nature, guided by natural selection. That is beyond belief when you see the evidence. So in a very real sense, I want you to be the jury tonight. I'm going to present the case, and I'm going to present it as hard as I know how to present it. And I want you to ask yourself the question, is it reasonable to believe there's a God that designed what I've just told you? Or is it more reasonable to believe this all came about by the forces of physics acting upon nature, guided by natural selection? You decide which is more reasonable. So let's talk about this from this perspective. You recognize this picture? I hope it's okay to get a little audience interaction here tonight. Is that all right with everybody? You're my class tonight. That's one of the most famous pictures ever made. It's called Earthrise. That's the Earth right there. What do you think this is? That's the surface of the moon. As a little sidelight, I have the original photograph of that in my office. If you want to hear that story, ask me later. I don't have time to tell you. But I have the original print of Earthrise in my office. All right, let me share with you a little information about this picture. This is from a book called The Privileged Planet, to which I'll refer a little more in a minute. On Christmas Eve, 1968, the Apollo 8 astronauts, Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders, became the first human beings to see the far side of the moon. You do know, don't you, class, that the moon rotates at the same rate it revolves, and so we always see the same side? You're nodding your head. Some of you knew that. These three men got to see the other side of the moon for the first time. The moment was as historic as it was perilous. They had been wrested from Earth's gravity and hurled into space by the massive, barely tested Saturn V rocket. Although one of their primary tasks was to take pictures of the moon in search of future landing sites, the first lunar landing would take place 7 months later. Were you listening when I started this? This is Christmas Eve, 1968. Who was alive then? Raise your hand, make me feel better. Christmas Eve, 1968. 7 months later, we were standing on the moon. 69. But many associate their mission with this photograph called Earthrise. Emerging from the moon's far side during their fourth orbit, the astronauts were suddenly transfixed by their vision of Earth. A delicate, gleaming swirl of blue and white contrasting with a monochromatic, barren lunar horizon. Earth had never appeared so small to human eyes, and yet was never more the center of attention. To mark the evening's events and significance and its occurrence on Christmas Eve, the crew had decided after much deliberation to read the following words that night. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The reading and the reverent silence that followed went out over a live telecast to an estimated 1 billion viewers, the largest single audience in television history. Were you listening that night? I was. I'll never forget it. Do you think that would be allowed today? Are you kidding? They'd be sent to jail for reading Genesis 1:1, such a public said. A lot of things have changed since 1960. The three men that witnessed this had exactly opposite reactions. Two of them, Frank Borman, Corbin and James Lovell became stronger believers in God. They looked at that and they thought, look at that beautiful place designed by God for human inhabitation. William Anders, on the other hand, looked at that and said, look at that little blue spot there in the middle of that massive nothingness. Do you sincerely think there's some kind of God that cares anything about us? And I can tell you the same evidence produces different reactions in different people. But some of them became stronger believers. Now I want to show you another picture. It's also become famous. The Voyager spacecraft was sent off in 1990. And it was sent off into outer space. You can see its path here. Here's Earth. And the Voyager was launched from Cape Canaveral, took off from Earth, and took this path, followed through the various orbits of all the different planets, and then outside of Pluto, it went right on. The object of Voyager 1 was to go as far into space as they could possibly go and continue to send signals back to Earth, pictures of outer space in 1990. And one of the most famous pictures from the Voyager spacecraft is this one. And now we need all the lights off, folks. Don't you go to sleep. We're turning the lights off because I want you to see this. And you might as well stay there because we're going to turn them off and on for a few times here. Ooh, that's good. Okay. You see that little blue dot right there? That arrow is not in the picture. That was superimposed later. And you see this kind of, it looks like a sun's ray, doesn't it? There's a book written about that little blue dot. It's called The Pale Blue Dot by Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, the one who promoted evolution as strongly as anybody has in our generation, the one who had the most popular TV show on science ever proposed, ever done, the Cosmos series, remember? The first line in that series, you want to put the lights back on a minute, I'm losing somebody here. The first line of the Cosmos series was, the cosmos, vast and enormous, is all there ever was, all there ever will be, and all there ever is. The cosmos, vast and eternal from which we have sprung, is all that's ever existed. That was Sagan's position. And in the pale blue dot, he had the following to say. Because of the reflection of sunlight, Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light as if there were some special significance to this small world. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. Our posturing, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this pale point of blue light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all of this vastness, there is no hint that help will come to save from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. You look at that little spot and you say, that's Earth from 3 billion miles away. And you say, you think God cares anything about that? You seriously think there's some God that cares about that little blue dot? If you were in Sagan's class at Princeton University class, here's what he'd say to you. You folks who are still believers in God better get over it. We've long since discovered there's no God out there that's going to come to save you. Your superstitious religious beliefs belong to the last century, not to the modern world. And now I'm throwing a little thing free of charge here. That's what your kids get when you send them to these big universities to study science. You parents better watch out where you're sending your children. You don't have any idea how bad it is. And it gets worse in the social sciences and in the psychological sciences, because they take what the scientists tell them and run with it. Be careful the environment in which you dump 18 and 19-year-olds. It is exactly the opposite of what you taught them. And they will be so out of step with everybody there that they will feel like little lost puppies because they don't know what to do about it. They're sitting at the feet of scoffers 8 hours a day. And then parents tell me, oh, but there's a good church down the road. You're fooling yourself. You need to put them in an environment where their faith is sustained and supported, not where it's torn down. That was thrown in for nothing. That's not part of my sermons. But it's absolutely the truth. And Carl Sagan is the classic illustration. He was teaching when I was in college, kids. He and a host of other blatant atheists who were belittling Christians every day. I know. I went through it. The pale blue dot, you see, is a treatise on the foolishness of believing in God. Carl Sagan, by the way, has passed from this life. I have an idea he knows better now than what he perpetrated while he was alive. But it didn't stop him from influencing an awful lot of people to become atheists. There was a book written while I was at Harvard in 1967-68 called Intelligent Life in the Universe by Carl Sagan and I.S. Schlosky. And the whole book, about this thick, which was required reading for my astronomy class, was about why we believe there's so many civilizations out there in outer space that are intelligent or maybe way far more intelligent than we are. And it was full of reasons why they believed that in the 1960s. And that Earth had been displaced from the center of the universe. God isn't focusing his attention on the Earth because it's sitting there in the center unmoving. Did you know that many people believed in the Middle Ages that the Earth sat there still and everything else revolved around it? It's called the geocentric theory. Did you know there are still hosts of people in the United States today that still believe that? It's called the Geocentric Society. I have a book this thick by them, absolutely declaring the Earth is sitting at the center of the universe without moving and everything else is revolving around it. Any of you in this audience believe that? I hope not, because it ain't so. The Bible doesn't teach it, and science doesn't teach it, but some folks think it does. And by the way, that thick book by the Geocentric Society quotes the Bible a lot. Because there are some passages in the Bible you can misinterpret to say that the earth sits in the center unmoving. It bothered a lot of Christians. And I can tell you the philosophers had a heyday with it when the geocentric theory went out the window. It was part of the whole notion you don't need God anymore. The earth is nothing spectacular. It's nothing unusual. In fact, the Copernican theory that the earth revolves around the sun threw it all into a cocked hat. Philosophers took that to say, well, the earth is no longer at the center. It's no, of course God's not focusing his attention on us. We're just average. And there's lots of other things like us out there in the universe. So why do you think you're something special? Evolution has taken place lots of places. So, are you sufficiently depressed? I'm not through with you yet. Drake's equation came out in the book in The Intelligent Life in the Universe by Sagan and Schlosky. And in it, he was trying to come up with some idea of how many civilizations there might be in our own galaxy. that we might be able to communicate with. So he came up with all these factors that would impact the number of communicating civilizations in our galaxy right now. Frank Drake. It was the biggest bunch of guesswork you ever saw in your life. The number of stars in the galaxy, about 200 billion. That's not so much a guesswork. The fraction of stars suitable for light, 0.05 to 0.3. That's anywhere from 1 times 10 to the 10th to 6 times 10 to the 11th. The fraction of suitable stars with planets. They had no clue about that, folks. It's a pure guess. The average number of habitable planets or moons per solar system. Again, a pure guess. The fraction on which life develops. Nobody had any idea about that. The fraction on which intelligent life develops. The fraction by which they can try to communicate. And the fraction of the stars' life during which communication civilization lasts. So their final answer was in somewhere between 0.000005 and 750,000. That's really helpful, isn't it? Somewhere between nothing and a million. Well, I'll tell you where they landed in the 60s. Carl Sagan and his bunch. They landed in the place. They said there's so many civilizations, even in our Milky Way galaxy, that the probability of there being another civilization even more advanced than ours is essentially one. You know what that means? It's absolutely certain. And it's just a matter of time before they get to us. In fact, lots of folks think they've already come. You know that. Bring little men on spaceships. There's lots of theories about that. And may I say this? While I was at Harvard, I spent a good portion of my time writing a special paper for astronomy on the myth of the little green men. There's essentially zero evidence that anybody's visited this planet from outer space. So don't go there. But lots of people are doing it, and it's a bunch of myths. But these folks think there's so many habitable civilizations in our own galaxy, it's probably a probability of one. And there's a book written by that name, The Probability of One, written in the 70s. Well, a lot's happened since then. And one of the things I've learned in my study of the sciences is if you don't know how to answer this stuff, and I'll tell you what, in those days I was lost. I didn't know how to answer this. Just wait about 20 years and let things unfold a little bit. So here's an interesting, very relatively new book written in 2004 called The Rare Earth. Now, folks, listen to me. These men, Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee, are thoroughgoing evolutionists. They don't believe in God. They're not talking in churches. These are thoroughgoing naturalists, evolutionists to the core. And in their book, they're saying why complex life is uncommon in the universe in 2004. In fact, they believe it's so uncommon there might not be another place in the whole universe like ours. You listening? So now we've gone from a probability of one to essentially a probability of zero in about 20 years. Well, it's fascinating. Now, they don't believe non-complex life is uncommon. Well, what's non-complex life, I'd like to ask you. Listen to me, ladies and gentlemen. I don't have time to talk to you about design at the microscopic level, but there is no such thing as non-complex life. I don't want to hear it. The simplest life form we know about is so massively complex we can't even comprehend it. Don't talk to me about non-complex life. There is no such thing. So when they say it's complex life that's uncommon, that's all life, folks. Every form of life we know is massively complex. But it's fascinating to me that in 2004 we have two evolutionists saying the Earth is rare. And believe me, they stuck their necks out to say that, because that's not commonly accepted among the scientific community. Wish I had time to tell you a whole lot more about that. But here's a second fascinating book that I've already read to you from called The Privileged Planet. by Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards. Guillermo Gonzalez is an astronomer at Iowa State University. This came out in 2004, and he and Richards dared to say in this book how our place in the universe is designed for discovery. The very same rare properties that allow for our existence. Look, I'm losing some of you. I want you to understand what I'm about to say, so you listen closely. These two men said, the very same rare properties that allow for our existence, they allow us to be here, are also providing the best overall setting to make discoveries about the world around us. So the same properties that allow us to exist allow us to have the best place in the universe to observe stuff. And their conclusion is, you may think that's an accident, it sure looks like a plan to us. And I say, amen. It sure looks like a plan to me too. You know what happened to Guillermo Gonzalez at Iowa State University? He was not given tenure because he dared to publish such a thing and embarrass his university with the notion that there might be a creator. Now, he never said that in the book, but he suggested it. And that's enough to turn the whole world against him. Great book. You need to read it. Gets a little heavy sometimes, or you can skip those parts. And then here's the one I sure enough want you to read. It's called God's Crime Scene by J. Warner Wallace. God's Crime Scene. You can get it in paperback, so it's cheap. J. Warner Wallace was raised in a home with a mother and father who were both atheists. He grew up believing there was no such thing as God. He became a cold case detective. And as a cold case detective, he began examining the evidence for a divinely created universe. He really thought that he'd prove it wasn't so, there was no divinely created universe. But he became convinced that there is one. And he became a believer. And he wrote this book because his daddy's still an atheist. And he wants to help his daddy become a believer. It's a powerfully good book, folks. God's Crime Scene. The universe, he says, is a crime scene. And we need to examine it as if it were a crime scene and look for evidence. Did somebody tamper with this? Was this created, or did this happen by natural causes? That's the question. And so he applies the methods of a cold case detective. You know what a cold case detective is? That's a detective that takes on a case that's been sitting there for years and nobody can solve it. It's one of the hardest jobs there is. And every chapter in this book, he starts with a case that he helped solve. And then he applies it to looking at the universe. Fascinating. So I'm going to share this a little bit with you tonight. And then build on it just a little bit. Here's one of the quotes from that book. Well, before I start there, I'm going to read you class. You can't fall asleep, but I'm going to read you a little bit from this book. This is chapter 2. The title of this chapter is Tampering with the Evidence. And he starts it with a case. So here we go. Everybody alert? I'm looking at you. Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room window, but the curtains were unusually drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked into the backyard of the old house, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. This wasn't like Carrie at all. She usually left one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. The couple had a child named Lexi, but the violence had only intensified since her birth. A week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie. And just last night, Carrie confided there had been yet another fight. When Helen couldn't get Carrie to answer the door this afternoon, she decided to call the police. Officers responded and met Helen at the door of Carrie's front porch. I'm going to skip some of this now. They went in and they found a smell of gas, and they called the hazmat agency immediately to do proper investigation. When they finally got everything investigated, they got to the second floor, found Carrie and Lexi dead. And a smell of gas in the whole house. Well, that case dragged on for a while. The question is, you have two dead bodies. Did that happen by natural causes? In other words, just a sequence of events that took place? Or was there tampering? Was there some outside force? Somebody from the outside managing this? In other words, was this a natural phenomenon or was it murder? Are you with me? So how do you go about this? I'll tell you what Warner would tell you. Jay Warner was. He said there are locational, regional, and foundational circumstances you investigate that all affect your thinking. And from that, you can draw conclusions. And I'm going to tell you the end of the story. Todd was convicted of first-degree murder based on the uncovering of these three lines of evidence by a jury of the peers. But it took a lot of work. We're compelled to examine the evidence of tampering in the universe because of one important fact. Not dead bodies, but living bodies. The fact is, there are a bunch of living people on this planet. How did that happen? So our investigation centers around, how do we get living things in this planet? The only place we know in the universe that has it. I want to say that again. The only place in the universe anybody knows anything about living things is right here. And the most amazing of those are sitting right here in this building. What's the answer to this? Like our murder scene, there are foundational, regional, and locational conditions that demand explanation. You remember all that stuff I told you about Helen? Why were those doors closed and locked? Why were the shades drawn? When they got inside, why were their clothes stuffed under the door of the bedroom? And a whole bunch of other lines of evidence. The foundational laws of physics, the regional properties of our solar system, and the locational conditions of our planet somehow resulted in our existence. How did that happen? Did that happen by natural causes? Or was there somebody tampering with this? You see what I'm saying? I think it's a wonderful way to approach this. Now I want to show you a little bit about why I believe there's been massive tampering, not by the Russians, but by the God of heaven. Here's a quote from the Goldilocks Enigma by Paul Davies. The universe is just right for life. One of the most significant facts, and arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we are part of it. Everyone agrees the universe looks as if it was designed for life. Folks, Paul Davies is an evolutionist through and through. He doesn't believe in God. But he admits the universe sure looks like it's been designed for living things. Okay, jury, maybe that happened by coincidence. Or maybe there really was a design. See, that's the question. But look, you don't have to believe me. You go look for yourself. There is zero disagreement about what I'm about to tell you. Zero. Everybody knows the universe looks like it was designed for life. it just looks like it. Here's another quote. It looks as if our universe is spectacularly fine-tuned for life. By this I mean only that it looks as if small changes in this universe's basic features would have made life's evolution impossible. You see, they don't want to give up evolution. But it sure looks suspicious here. Because it looks like everywhere you look, this looks like it was designed for something. But no, it wasn't. Can't have that. Y'all remember the story of Goldilocks? Kids, who can help me with Goldilocks? She went out in the forest and what? She found whose house? The bear's house. Thank you. Don't be bashful. She found the bear's house. She went inside, didn't she? That's called breaking and entering. And she found on the table. Well, no, that's not where she went first. Yeah, she went to the table. What'd she find? Say it, somebody. Bowls of porridge. And so she tasted the first one, and it was too hot. It was daddy's porridge, right? Too hot. Then she tried mama's porridge, and it was too cold. But then she tried baby's porridge, and it was just right, and she ate it all. And then she did several other things the same way, right? But it was always the baby's thing was just right. The Goldilocks enigma class is that when it comes to the universe, there are a thousand things that look like they were just right to support life. Now, did that just happen? By accidental means, the blind forces of physics? Or was there somebody tampering with that and making it that way? See, that's what I'm going to ask you. Which do you think is more reasonable? And we're just getting started. I'm painting the picture. The anthropic principle, which nobody argues with. Anthropic is the word for humans. Anthropos. When I was in school in the 1960s, scientists had discovered two characteristics of the cosmos that seemed to be fine-tuned to make physical life, and particularly human life, possible. There were 8 to 10 characteristics of the solar system, such fine-tuned as they had found by the 60s. But we're here in the 2000s class. Now we have found over 38 characteristics of the cosmos that are fine-tuned for human life, and over 150 characteristics of our solar system that are all fine-tuned. You know what that's like? In this case I told you about, it's like, what is that? 188 different circumstantial pieces of evidence in that house and surrounding here, all pointing to one thing. Fine-tuned for humans to be here. Sounds like a plan to me. So let's talk about a few of these. There are 188 of them. You think I'm going to get through all that tonight? No, that's why this is a 2-year course. But there are foundational issues that are fine-tuned. They're just right. Light, the strong and weak nuclear forces, the electromagnetic force, the gravitational force, the ratio of electrons to protons. Pardon me, let me go back to that. Whoops, it's going back, Brad. Can I get back to it? I need to go back.
Yeah, but
it won't do it. It won't do it. All right, while he's getting that fixed, I'm going to read you a little more. These are foundational. I'll tell you what that was with regard to the previous case. That's things like Todd and Carrie's marriage relationship. That was very rocky, even life-threatening. That's foundational, folks. That's background information to help you decide this might have been a murder, right? These are foundational principles of the universe. The strong and weak nuclear force, these two. I'm not even going to talk to you about those. The ratio of electrons to protons, that is massively important. Listen to this statement. If the value of the ratio of electrons to protons deviated by more than 1 in 10 to the 37th, this universe as we know it would not even exist. I lost you.
finely tuned that if you mess with it, 1 out of 10 to the 37th, there would be no universe. I'm going to give you that illustration. I'm going to show you what that means. You ready? Imagine covering the entire North American continent in dimes and stacking them until they reach the moon. Now imagine stacking just as many dimes again on another 1 billion continents of the same size as North America. So you've got 1 billion and 1 continents the size of North America with dimes stacked on to the moon. Got that? If you mark one of those dimes and hid it in the billions of piles that you would assemble, the odds of a blindfolded friend picking out the correct dime is approximately 1 out of 10 to the 37th. The same level of precision required in the ratio of electrons to protons for this universe to exist. Every one of those is just that sensitive. If any one of them were changed by something so tiny you can't even measure it, there would be no universe, much less life. Those are facts. Nobody argues with them. Now, how did it come about that we have a universe that is so finely tuned that all of those factors are that finely tuned? How'd that come about? Well, one could argue it had to happen somewhere. It had to happen here. And we're the place in the universe where it happened to happen. That's all. Well, look, maybe that would be the case if you had 5 or 6 of these, 2 or 3. But how about 38 of them? How many is it going to take, jury, convince you that this had tampering? You see the case I'm building? We haven't even got started. There are regional fine-tuned factors that support life, and they're just right. Here are some of them. You have to have the proper galaxy. You know, Sagan liked to talk about billions and billions of stars and billions of galaxies, and there are. The problem is, most of them can't support life. And everybody knows it. You have to have the right kind of galaxy. So let's see here. We've got the Hubble telescope now. Don't be out there taking pictures if you've never gone out and taken a look at Hubble telescope pictures on the internet. You must go do it. Here's one of them. That's a picture of a portion of the constellation Serpens. Look at that. That's just one tiny piece of our universe we're looking at. And look at all those stars. You see all those stars? Like that one, and 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 that one. Folks, those are not stars. Those are galaxies that contain at least 200 billion stars. It's massive just in this one little piece of our universe. Carl Sagan was exactly right. This universe is so full of stars, there surely has to be some other place like us up there somewhere. But here's the problem. Elliptical galaxies will not work. Everybody knows it. Elliptical galaxies can never support a planetary system like ours that has life on planets. Let's turn the lights back on. And you know what percentage of galaxies are elliptical? 80%. That means 8 out of 10 galaxies are out! And everybody knows it. There's no life in elliptical galaxies. How about irregular galaxies? They're a mess, class. They don't support living things. There's another type I don't have up here called Seyfert galaxies. They blow up every few years. Not real helpful. The fact is, of all the types of galaxies that exist, spiral galaxies are the one type of galaxy that is pretty good for supporting life. Guess what the Milky Way is? Spiral galaxy. Well, look, the evolutionists would say this just happens to be the kind of galaxy it had to be to support living things. Well, it's possible. It just a chance happening.
But the problem class is there's 50 of these. There's 150.
There aren't very many spiral galaxies. So that eliminates most of the constellations in the universe. You also have to have the proper place in the galaxy. Look, even if it's a spiral galaxy, you can't have it. Look at the side here. There's a spiral galaxy on its side that has a bulge in the middle. That's very much like an elliptical galaxy right in there. There are going to be no planetary systems in there supporting life. If you're going to have life in a spiral galaxy, it's going to be right here in that little bulge or right here in that one. It's less than 10% of the space of a galaxy. So that means 90% is eliminated. Are you still with me? I'm not losing you. Most galaxies are eliminated, and most spiral galaxies are eliminated. Most parts of it. And nobody argues that. But now within that, you've got to have the right kind of star. Our sun happens to be just right. Well, it's just a pure coincidence that our sun is just right. How just right is it? Well, here's our sun compared to our planets. You see all these little planets down here relative to the size of the sun? You think the sun is massive. Well, it is massive compared to Jupiter and Earth. But here's our sun compared to some other stars. Here's Sirius, the dog star, and Pollux and Arcturus. The sun is very small compared to Arcturus, folks. There's stars way bigger than our sun. In fact, Arcturus is relatively small, too, if I showed you all the rest of them. I don't think I have another picture. Yeah, here it is. There's Arcturus, Rigel, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, and Antares! You can hardly find Arcturus, and where's the sun down there? It's one pixel right there. Folks. Can I tell you that all these massive stars, like all these big ones up there, they could never support a planetary system? Let me show you. If you try to have planets around even Arcturus, much less Antares, here's what would happen. Here's a planet circling around and go. In microseconds, it would smash into the surface of that star. And everybody knows it. So you know those billions and billions of stars that are out there? Billions and billions of them are useless for life. But the sun, just right. In fact, the sun is about in the middle of all the stars that exist. Is that interesting? Of course, that just happened. Well, the evolutionists said, well, sun has to be in the middle. If you're going to have all these sizes of stars, something's in the middle, and our sun has to be that one. Then you have to have the proper mass of the planet. It's not just any old planet. Let me ask you, class, where are we looking for signs of life in our own solar system besides Earth? Where are we looking? Mars. Are we looking on Jupiter? Of course not, because everybody knows Jupiter is so massive, there's no life there. It's so massive that if you try to have life, it would die instantly from the gravitational force. And everybody knows it. You see, in our solar system, Jupiter's out, Saturn's out, Uranus is out, Neptune's out, Earth and Mars. This is Mars right here. Venus is closer to our size. Why aren't we looking on Venus? Anybody know? Well, it's not really so much too hot. Huh?
Too gaseous.
It's got sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. Not too good for living things. You ever put sulfuric acid on yourself? Don't try it. Kids, don't you do it. Venus is out, folks. So they're looking on Mars, trying to find some evidence there might be some kind of water up there to show that there was some kind of life. And why is that? The planet has to have the right mass. That's not going to support life. How about locational fine-tuned factors to support life? Do you think I've left off about 100? I have. I'm skipping. Shame on me. And I do want to let you go before the night's out. Now, Paul preached till midnight, so I have example. The planet has to be the right distance from the sun. Planets circle the sun. There's what you call a habitable zone. Exactly a certain region. It's very small, relatively speaking. You get outside that habitable zone, there will be no life. Period. Everybody knows that. That's true in our solar system. It's true in everybody else's. It has to have the right spin. And by the way, guess where the Earth sits? Right in the middle of the habitable zone. Well, it just there had to be one there. That's just purely chance. The Earth happened to be the right one in the habitable zone. The right spin and the right tilt. You know how important all that is? That deserves 3 lectures each. The Earth rotates one time in how long, class? About 24 hours, right? We rotate once about every 24 hours. You know how important that is? It's critically important to your survival. The Earth is tilted at 23.5 degrees. You know how important that is? You studied that in junior high school. Because that does this, right? That allows for the what? The seasons. But do you think that's all that's involved in the 23.5 degrees? Class, we haven't even begun to start. That's 3 more lectures. The 23.5, you know what you need to do tonight? You need to go home and thank God for 23.5 degrees. You wouldn't be here without it. Well, some planet had to tilt at 23.5 degrees. Out of all the possible planets, there might be somewhere. Some planet had to be at that. Okay. My question to you is, how many of those are we going to have to say just happened? You have to have the right moon. You don't have any idea how important the moon is. Our moon is just right. It's not too big. It's not too little. It's located the right distance from us. It rotates the right way. Everything about the moon is just right to support life. Wouldn't you love to have 3 lectures on there? It's also pretty nice for sitting with your girlfriend. But there's way more to the moon than that. Pluto has 5 moons. The other planets have several moons. We have 1, and it's just right. Well, look, some moon had to be just right. Right? You have to have the right atmospheric conditions, too. Sulfuric acid doesn't get it. Who knows the makeup of our atmosphere? It's 80% what? Come on, class, you know this. 80% of our atmosphere is nitrogen. And a substance that is relatively unreactive. That's very good. About 20% of our atmosphere is what? Oxygen. Very reactive. If we didn't have it, we'd be dead. If it worked within a very narrow range of variability, we'd be dead anyway. If we had too much of it, we'd all burn up. If we had too little of it, we couldn't breathe. And a host of other things. Just the right territorial crust. You know how important that is? The crust we're standing on? And 140 more that I don't have time to tell you about. That are fine-tuned locational factors. Listen, if J. Warner Wallace had had that much circumstantial evidence to put into his case, he'd have convicted in every jury on earth. So the question is, you really believe in your heart of hearts and all of these fine-tuned factors that are Goldilocks enigmas, you think all of those happen by the blind forces of physics acting upon nature to the point that we got all these coincidences, boom, here's life. And then there's water. If you were in my chemistry class, we'd study water for 6 weeks. It's the most researched substance on the face of the earth to this day. It's the most incredible substance there is. Everything about it is unusual. It covers more than 70% of the Earth's surface. You know that on Mars they're trying to find some little teeny bit of evidence for water? It covers 70% of our surface! And 60% of most plants and animals are water by volume. So kids, when your sister calls you waterhead, she's right. It has a unique structure. Everybody knows it's two H's and an O, right? Hydrogen, hydrogen, oxygen. What you don't know is that this right here is critically important. The angle between the two hydrogen atoms as they bond with oxygen is 104.5 degrees. That's another one you should pray about. If you didn't have 104.5 degrees in a water molecule, you'd be dead. There would be no life. Ask me to explain that, and I will tell you, come to my chemistry class. It's the only substance on Earth that exists in all three states. It has a uniquely high specific heat. Its wide temperature range for liquid. It's less dense as a solid. Did you drink iced tea today? Did you happen to notice there were blocks of water floating in your iced tea? Solid water floats. That's the exact opposite of what's supposed to happen. Solids are more dense than liquids in almost every substance there. Not water. When you get below 4 degrees centigrade, water expands. You know why? Because at 104.5 degrees, it gets locked in space because it's not vibrating as much. And then there are spaces between the molecules that make it less dense, and so it floats. You know what would happen to you if water didn't float? You'd be dead. It's another of those unique properties of water that allows living things to exist. Oh, you know the most frustrating thing to me about this lecture? I always leave it and say to myself, there were 16 other things I should have said. Because there are. It's the universal solvent. It has high surface tension. Everywhere we look, ladies and gentlemen, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, everything sure looks like it's designed. The evolutionist says, oh, it sure looks like that, but it isn't. It's all the blind forces of physics acted upon by natural selection, which overrides all the improbabilities. Look, folks, if natural selection is that grand, it's God Himself. And if you, after this teeny, inadequate, pitiful explanation, can still believe that life on Earth and Earth itself is not designed by some master, amazing designer, I got a bridge to sell you down in Everglades. Because the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? There is zero excuse left for anyone missing. There has to be a grand designer for what we've observed. It can be, it cannot be otherwise. I hope I've given you some evidence on which to build your case. So, that's my lesson. I thank you for your careful attention. We don't wish to leave such an assembly as this without giving someone an opportunity who's learned enough about the Creator to want to go further. So here's my appeal to you. If something I've said tonight to you, if you're an atheist or an agnostic, or you just don't know, if I've said something that makes you question your previous position, would you please take it further? And here's where I'd like you to take it.
In John, the 14th chapter of the Bible, which I'm convinced is also directly from God, that's another whole line of study, Jesus said, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may go and be also. And where I go, you know, and the way you know." So he said, if you believe in God, you need to believe in Jesus also. He's going away, but he's coming back. And he said in verse 6 of the same passage, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me." So I'm telling you this evening, there's way more to this story than just believing in God. Because the Bible tells us that God loved us enough that he sent his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. It tells us that same Son loved us so much that he gave his own life in our place. He died, was buried, and rose again, went back to heaven. He's coming back again to receive everybody who believes in him and follows his way into heaven itself. We hope you believe that. And if you do, here's what Jesus said. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. He who does not believe will be condemned. So everything's ready, if you're a believer, to baptize you right here, isn't it? Everything's ready? And we can do that tonight. Won't you come while we stand and as we sing?
Jesus.